whereupon sat the black letters, arranged as consonants and vowels, proper names and improper nouns, verbs as well as adjectives, whose syntax said, no, you cannot love her, not now, nor forevermore. Oh, I loved you once. Outside the calligraphy, beyond the fountain of fonts, in the margins of empty space there, where I placed you, I contextualized you, alone and unscripted, augmented without words, unimpeded by the black letters, I had you to myself in the open recess of my mind and the margins of my love. Yes, I loved you once. As sure as the sun rises and shines, even as the sea ripples roll, as the black letters stand tall there, foreshadowing things to come, like magi who traveled from the east. These things the black letters speak. In between the lines they speak. There being no room for you there. That's why I summoned you to the margins. To the margins of my mind. More so now. I loved you once.
Thank you, KABU members, for supporting this great station, and you can apply today to join our board of directors to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to great use. The role played by our KABU Board of Directors is essential. It's a great way to become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all our members. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month, and you must be a KABU member. To apply, go to KABU.fm and fill out an application, or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is April 16th. 2018. We need folks who love KABU and are committed to our community values. KABU needs you. Apply today.
Tune in to KABU on Saturday, April 21st from 5:30 to midnight to hear a live broadcast of the 7th Annual Inner City Blues Festival. The evening starts off with Steve Chesboro and a country blues set at 5:30 p.m. Later performers include the I&I Band Reunion, King Louis Payne Quartet featuring LaRonda Steele, the Norman Sylvester Review, the Mattis Held Doctors and Nurses, and more. Again, that's the Inner City Blues Festival on Saturday, April 21st from 5:30 to midnight at the North Portland Eagles Lodge and live on your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Portland, community radio for the Pacific Northwest. Stay tuned at midnight for Joe Woods. Right now, the following program may contain language and situations not suitable for young audiences. But of course, it's the bedtime radio show for grown-ups, Gremlin Time.
Good evening and welcome to Gremlin Time. This is Fortunato. Oh boy, I have one of those evenings where everything goes wrong. I had a show planned out. I was going to do a Howard Brown mystery with his character, Paul Pine. But the recording I put together wasn't quite put together. So tonight, I'm going to read live for the next hour, and I've just selected a book that I've gotten from the library. This is A History of Comedians by Cliff Nesteroff, and it's called The Comedians. I'm going to read this chapter about nightclubs, and this is about nightclubs in the 30s. And the previous chapter, it ended about talking about radio comedians, Henry Morgan and Fred Allen, and how they had had to go butt heads against the owners of the radio stations and the networks. So chapter 3, Nightclubs, by Cliff Nesteroff, Nightclubs. If Fred Allen or Henry Morgan criticized their broadcast overlords, the worst that happened was cancellation. While cancellation was indeed awful for a comic, it did not compare with the perils facing comedians who performed in nightclubs on a regular basis. Organized crime and nightclub comedy coexisted. Mob-run speakeasies employed entertainment during the days of Prohibition. When Prohibition was repealed in 1933, vaudeville was dead, and the speakeasies turned into legitimate nightclubs and became the primary venues for comedians. If you were a stand-up comedian, you worked for the mob. The mob essentially created the term stand-up comic, according to 86-year-old comedian Dick Curtis. The outfit used to manage fighters. A stand-up fighter is a guy that is a puncher. A stand-up guy was a guy who was tough and you could depend on. The outfit managed fighters, and they managed clubs that booked comics, so the term found its way into the lexicon of nightclubs. A guy who just stood there and punched jokes, joke, joke, joke. He was a stand-up comic. Comedians playing Chicago during the dying days of vaudeville found themselves victim of mob shakedowns. Lou Holtz, Georgie Price, Ted Healy all paid off for their so-called protection, said George Jessel. If they didn't, they were told they would get hurt. Remember Joey Lewis? Was the usual admonition. That admonition would never work today, as nobody remembers Joey Lewis. From 1935 until his death in 1971, Joey Lewis was the comedian at the forefront of the mob's nightclub network. He was everywhere. El Rancho in Las Vegas, Ciro's in Hollywood, the Copacabana in New York. Lewis was possibly the most prolific nightclub comedian who ever lived. But he almost didn't live at all. Lewis defied the mob and paid the price in gore. In 1927, he already had been booked for a lengthy engagement at a small Chicago club called the Green Mill Cocktail Lounge. When he was lured down the street for a gig at the New Rendezvous. Both venues were run by the mob. Unfortunately for Lewis, they were rival factions. The Green Mill was owned by Machine Gun Jack McGurn, an Al Capone associate. Taking a gig elsewhere without permission was an act of treason. But Lewis was a show business novice who thought nothing of it. Three mob enforcers came to his hotel room to teach him a lesson. What happened next became a symbol for the decades-long relationship between comedians and the mob, as described in the 1958 biography, The Joker is Wild, by Art Cohn. A horrendous blow struck him from behind. He turned as he fell and saw the man with the .38 raising his arm to hit him again. The third assailant was unsheathing a hunting knife. Pain coiled around his brain, tightened and tighter, tighter and tighter, and sank its fangs deeper and deeper. The knifeman went to work. He punched the blade into Joe's left jaw as far as he could, ripped his face open from ear to throat, and went on cleaving impassionately, like a butcher. He was lying on the floor, his face immersed in a pool of blood. It took 3 years for Joey Lewis to regain the ability to talk. As a comic, words were his trade. The average comedian building an act from nothing had it tough enough, but now he had to do it while relearning how to speak. Years later, mobster Sam Giancana admitted he had been involved. Jack McGurn sent me, Needles Gianola, and another punk over to pay him a visit. We beat him to a pulp and pistol whipped him real good. Shit, we cut his fucking throat from stern to stern. His goddamn tongue was hanging by a string out of his mouth when we got done with him. It's a fucking wonder the guy lived. One thing we didn't count on was how other entertainers would react. There isn't a star alive now who'd turn us down. When Lewis staged his comeback in the early 1930s, crowds got a look at the fleshy scar that started at his left ear and curved across his neck. They heard the obvious rasp and struggle to establish command. The fact that Lewis survived and recovered was remarkable. More incredible, by the time Prohibition was repealed, he was a headlining professional, appearing to the code of the street. He refused to comply with police and name the men who sliced him. Back from the dead, refusing to squeal, Joe E. Lewis now had the respect of every mob outfit in the United States. As a result, his career was set for life. Alcohol was legal, and vaudeville was dead. Milton Berle was oscillating between the half-empty vaudeville houses and the post-speakeasy nightclub world, trying to determine how to make a living without the power of the vaudeville theater chain owned by Keith Albee behind him. Nightclubs required comedians to have longer acts than in vaudeville. The average vaudeville turn was anywhere from 8 to 18 minutes. In a nightclub, a comedian needed 45. Burl didn't have that, so in order to stretch his time, he would ridicule the crowd. He picked on a random table at the Vanity Fair Club in New York, but was unable to invoke any laugh. In a typical nightclub story of the time, a mobster nicknamed Pretty Amberg had a fondness for puncturing people's faces with a fork, said columnist Earl Wilson. Milton Berle, then a young comic, didn't know Amberg was sensitive to remarks about himself. Glancing at Amberg's table one night at the old Vanity Fair, Berle said, "Oh, it's novelty night. You're with your wife." Berle recalled, "When the show ended, I went straight to my dressing room. Table 12 wants to see you. Nobody at the table nodded and said hello or even smiled at me. When the waiter left, no one spoke. I was getting very nervous, so I said, 'Did you like the show?' 'No, it stunk.' He yanked my face close to his." Amber grabbed Burl's throat and began pulling on his tie, said Wilson. Burl was choking helpless. Then Amber reached for a fork, ready to tear Burl's face with it. "He jabbed the fork straight into my chin," said Burl. Mobster Marty Cropier stepped in and grabbed his wrist and forced his hand open. I got the hell out from that table as fast as I could. Cropier pushed me into the street, pushed me into a cab, and gave the driver the name of a doctor the local boys had on call. I got 2 stitches for each prong of the fork, 8 stitches in all. Amberg was later found dead in cement, said Wilson. His penis had been cut off and jammed into his mouth. This was the mobster's way of saying that a victim had talked too much. For a good 45 years, the mob controlled American show business. It was always outfit to us, said comedian Dick Curtis. Never the mob or Costa Nostra or any of the other names you might have heard. These guys were the outfit. From the 1930s to the end of the 1960s, every city in America had at least one glamorous supper club, if not four or five, featuring the top headliners in every showbiz genre. Furthermore, it didn't matter if these clubs were in Cleveland, Portland, Corpus Christi, or Baton Rouge. If it was a nightclub, the owners were the mob. The clubs were owned by bootleggers. And even a few killers, said actor George Raft, who had worked as a dancer in New York supper clubs. In my time, I knew or met them all. Al Capone, Joe Adonis, Frank Costello, Vito Genovese, Dutch Schultz, Machine Gun McGurn, Lucky Luciano, Vinnie Cole. Most of them were around. The mob was very, very good to me, says 91-year-old comedian Rose Marie, best known as Sally on the Dick Van Dyke Show. As a nightclub performer in the 1940s, she was regularly booked at the Beverly Hills Supper Club in Newport, Kentucky, a mob venue that was intentionally burned to the ground on two different occasions. Insulting the mob connected was a common problem for comedians, as Milton Berle had learned. You had to be cautious. In New York, five caustic insult comics, Vince Curran, Frankie Hyers, Fred Lamb, Pat Harrington Sr., and Jack White, figured out a way around the risk. In 1938, they opened Club 18. Its whole mandate was insult comedy. It was known in advance that patrons would be ridiculed, thereby downplaying the risk of the wrong person being angered. Club 18 was named for its address on West 52nd Street, the former domain of Red McKinsey, a preeminent comb and wax paper soloist. Taking over the jazz joint, Curran, Hyers, Lamb, Harrington, and White made it the Bollywick of angry comics for 10 successful years. Jack White was a wild kind of a guy for those days, a leader of comics, says Pat Harrington Jr. By the second year of Club 18, everybody knew what the place was about. If a guy looked like he was from the Midwest, then you treated him that way and insulted him. But if he had any kind of a broken nose or scarred forehead, your instinct was to avoid him. Jack White was the first modern insult comic. He had balls like no other. Comedians Bob Hope, George Jessel, and Rags Raglan sat in his audience as willing targets. It was a comics room where comedians actually laughed rather than sneered from a back table. The five comedians simultaneously berated patrons. From backstage, Frankie Hyers would shout, "And away we go!" And with individual mics, they prowled the crowd. There were all manners of insults, wrote Life magazine. When a well-dressed guest arrived, Jack cordially invites him to stand up and take a bow. Then Pat yells, "Sit down, you bum!" And Frank adds, "That's no bum. Bums take baths." Arnold Shaw, chronologer of 52nd Street, wrote, "No small part of the club's audience consisted of would-be comics, as well as the leading comics of the day. In fact, there were so many gagsters around that it was difficult to know who was part of the act and who was just sitting in." Club 18 occasionally used great comedians when one of the primary five was on the road. Jack Waldron was a good fit. He honed his insult stick at Lamb's Club lambasting, a rival offshoot of Friars Club roasts. Comic Benny Rubin said Waldron was the first Don Rickles and Jackie Leonard. His task was a little more difficult, however, because he insulted guys who would shoot you. Agent Willie Weber said Frank Lamb, to use a comedian, he represented a fat kid who usually played queens. His name was Jackie Gleason. Oh, okay. So, yeah. Agent Willie Weber asked Frank Lamb to use a comedian he represented, a fat kid who usually played queens. His name was Jackie Gleason, and he became a regular. Gleason said every time somebody like Frank Hires or Pat Harrington or Jack White couldn't make it, it was little Jackie boy who stepped in and always saved the day. Gleason picked up some of his familiar phrases at Club 18. Frankie Hires was the guy who invented the phrase, "And away we go," says straight man Peter Marshall. It was his catchphrase, and then Jackie Gleason took it. Gleason, Harrington, and Hires eventually became regular performers in Miami Beach. The same could be said of almost every comedian of their era. Dominated by the mob element, there was more nightclubs in South Florida than anywhere else in the country. In the words of comedian Alan King, Miami Beach was the Vegas of the 1940s. Lax laws in regards to gambling and prostitution made it an attractive vacation spot. South Florida was transformed into America's playground during the Great Depression. To buoy the sinking economy, restrictions on party mutual gambling were erased. Desperate people flooded the region and wasted their meager dollars on new dog tracks, horse tracks, and casinos. Construction boomed with 40 new hotels opening in 1940 alone. Early Miami was marvelous, and there were big gambling places way out past Miami toward Hollywood, Florida, says comedian Jack Carter. There were places like Green Acres and the Colonial Inn, and they would play four people on one bill. Sophie Tucker, Harry Richmond, Joey Lewis, Milton Berle. They would all be on one show. It was big, big time showbiz. They had dice games going on and stuff like that. All on the QT, says comedian Woody Woodbury. You'd go into the back room. It was like walking into a showroom in Vegas. You couldn't believe the gambling there in the old days. At mid-century, Time magazine called Miami Beach the prime destination for Americans on the make, on the lam, or on a pension. It was also the prime destination for comedians. The beach was a place where total nobodies like Jackie Clark, Artie Dan, and Frankie Scott could make a living reciting their joke book hack work. At the same time, they could brush shoulders with giants like Milton Berle, George Burns, and George Jessel. Everybody did the beach. It had the largest concentration of stand-up comedy in the United States. Comedian Bobby Ramson got his break in Miami Beach playing the Nautilus Hotel. I jumped at the chance to be playing Miami Beach. Every year they'd put up a new hotel. When World War II was over, America had a party We had won the war. People were working. Money was no object. People were going out every night. Every town in America, every other door in every small town in America was a nightclub. Comics were working. Marimba bands opening the show, dance teams, contortionists. Everybody had a job in show business. During the winter of 1950, the region had more than 300 hotels in operation. The number of hotels operating in Las Vegas at the same time was 4. It was a hedonistic culture where tourists indulged in booze, drugs, gambling, and girls. A comedian could do a show at midnight, seduce a woman at 3, wander into the 5 o'clock club, and drink till dawn. Jack Carter says, "The people that stayed at the big hotels would go early to the Colonial Inn or the Copa City. The 5 o'clock club stayed open for the late mobs. You really had to be on your toes to work that crowd. That's when Murderers Row came in." The 5 o'clock club was a compact joint at 22nd and Collins Avenue. When it first opened, it meant class. Leo Lazaro and his Continentals played sultry waltzes, and Lady Vine belted out the standards. The advertisements boasted that it was elaborately decorated in the modern manner. But like so many class nightclubs, it drifted into depravity. The 5 o'clock club frayed and lost its allure. In an attempt to boost business, Martha Ray was offered a piece of the club if she would allow her name to appear above the sign. The scheme worked, and Martha Ray's 5 o'clock club reopened as a party spot where high society shared space with drug addicts. I went down there, and Martha Ray was a big star, supposedly, said Shucky Green. This guy named the club after her, and it was successful for a while. I went in, and I really didn't know what was happening. Strange people hanging out at the bar. All of a sudden, I smell this stuff. They were all hitting on amyl nitrate. The whole club. Errol Flynn came in. He was on amyl nitrate. It was the kind of place where comedians, no matter how bad their act was, could always find a stripper to lay. The kind of place where rim shots were born and backstage babies conceived. The 5 o'clock club brought in comedians, and Martha would take their stuff, says Green. I would come back to work for her, and the band leader would say, "Don't do your French routine. She's doing it." Well, it was my routine. Another compact venue was the Vagabond Club, a joint named for a musical novelty act with a stoned accordion player. "I worked with the Vagabonds on and off for 7 years, says Woody Woodbury. They were a tremendous hit down there. They opened up their own place, a real plush place. Jack Carter says they were a good act. Altillo Riso played the accordion and created a lot of the hippie stoned jokes. The Vagabonds, like all the others, were connected to the mob. Vagabonds members, Babe Piper says, the mob were always good to us. They were great guys to us." Miami Beach was stand-up comedy's busiest city. but the whole country was littered with club dates. When we say a club date, we mean one-nighter, says old-time comic Milt Moss. An organization would send out a singer, a dancer, a comedian for a club date. Today, that has faded out. But there used to be tremendous work between New York, Chicago, Boston, Philadelphia, Miami, and Houston. Many of them had back rooms with casinos or bookmakers. By the end of the 1940s, Democratic Senator Estes Kefauver of Tennessee was going after them. A mild-mannered Machiavellian in disguise, Kefauver railed against mob-run gambling rooms and made the issue to prominence, perfectly timed with the rise of television. Kefauver became the first real celebrity politician of the television age. Kefauver's attack on the mob officially started January 5, 1950, when he introduced Senate Resolution 202. It called for an investigation of organized crime in the United States. The committee started work on May 10, 1950. Kefauver launched the U.S. Senate Special Committee to investigate crime in interstate commerce. Suddenly, people knew the name Frank Costello as well as they knew the name Kefauver. Kefauver's battle was a touchy one. The mob's power was concentrated in the big cities of America, but were overwhelmingly liberal. Consequently, the majority of the politicians in the pocket of the mob were Democratic office holders, and their Democratic colleague Kefauver was about to expose them. By default, the liberal senator became a hero to Republicans and a pariah to his own to his own party. Oh, man, hold on. I'm going to take a little musical break here.
Second place. Oh, sweet and slow.
I'm reading this evening on Gremlin Time from The Comedians by Cliff Nesteroff. It's a history, drunks, thieves, scoundrels, and the history of American comedy. I'm going to skip ahead. I'm reading about nightclubs in the 40s and so. So I'm going to skip ahead here. The biggest comedy act to come out of the Manhattan presentation house world was Martin and Lewis. Just as young girls had shrieked for Sinatra, the fervor surrounding Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis at the Paramount was enormous. Lewis started in clubs with a record act, a common convention used by amateur comedians with no material. A popular song was played off stage on a record player, while a comic mugged expressions and gestures in time to the track. British-born actor Reginald Granger was said to have originated the idea. One tally had it that by 1940, there were more than 200 such acts in the biz. Comedy writer Philip Rapp recalled seeing the early Jerry Lewis. It was in a downtown cafe somewhere on Broadway, and business was brisk. He had a mop on his head, and he was going through the motions of conducting an orchestra. Well, a photograph record played in the background. He also walked on his instep and imitated a spastic. I was not impressed. Dean Martin was a struggling crooner with a massive snoz. The New Jersey native was connected to comedians from the start. His roommate in the early days was a struggling Alan King, who also did a record act. One of Martin's early boosters was Lou Costello of Abbott and Costello. "I even advanced him enough to have his nose bobbed," said Costello. "He wasn't even bothered so much as to call me. He hasn't even bothered so much as to call me." Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis were occasionally booked on the same shows. They had a nice chemistry, and their interactions turned to shtick. Suddenly, they were a team, accelerating at an incredible pace, scoring choice bookings at Bill Miller's Riviera in Fort Lee, New Jersey, Slapsy Maxie's in Los Angeles. Martin was calm, cool, and suave. While Lewis was gawky, obnoxious, and animated. Martin would sing a song, and Lewis would run through the crowd, knocking over dishes and chairs. Clubgoers ate it up. There's... Their spell at the Paramount established them as stars. Life magazine encapsulated it with a classic photo spread. Accompanying newsreel footage showed the duo being swarmed by fans and hounded by screaming girls, tearing at their shirts, the closest thing to Beatlemania comedy has ever had. Frequent collaborator Norman Taurog said the response was almost orgasmic. They became so big, so fast, that veteran comedians complained bitterly. "They're using all my best bits," complained Milton Berle. Comedian Jackie Leonard said, "This is a nothing act. When Martin and Lewis do isn't basically funny, but nobody else has the gall to do it in a sophisticated cafe where they're paying you $20,000 a week. When you figure other comics have struggled all their lives." Oh, man. Boy, I'm just losing my voice here tonight. I'm going to just get a little more music on here and Maybe we'll come back. I'm reading from The Comedians, Cliff Nesteroff's book about drunks, thieves, scoundrels, and the history of American comedy.
I met him at a party just a couple of years ago. He was rather overhearty and ridiculous. But as I'd seen him on the screen, he cast a certain spell. I basked in his attraction for a couple of eyes or so. His manners were a fraction too meticulous. If he was real or not, I couldn't tell. But like a silly fool, I fell mad about the boy. I know it's stupid to be mad about the boy. I'm so ashamed of it, but must admit, the sleepless nights I've had about the boy. On the silver screen, he melts my foolish heart in every single scene. Although I'm quite aware that here and there are traces of the cat about the boy. Lord knows I'm not a fool, girl. I really shouldn't care. Lord knows I'm not a schoolgirl in the flurry of her first affair. Will it ever cloy, this odd diversity of misery and joy? I'm feeling quite insane and young again, and all because I'm mad about the boy. Lord knows I'm not a fool, girl. I really shouldn't care. Lord knows I'm not a schoolgirl in the flurry of her first affair. Will it ever cloy, this odd diversity of misery and joy? I'm feeling quite insane and young again, and all because I'm mad about the boy. Oh, I'm mad about the boy. Thank you.
Ella Logan there doing the up down lowdown, and before that the wonderful Ginny Simms with a sweet Ginny Simms, not Nan Wine. You listen to the Monday Sampler. I'm going to read a little bit more out of this book before my voice totally goes away. Joe Woods was going to volunteer to read, but he admitted that he was a worse reader than I am right now. So a little bit more here from The Comedians by Cliff Nesteroff, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy. Don Rickles was, after Shooky Green, the next Las Vegas lounge comedian. Don Rickles graduated from the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in 1946. His prestigious schooling equipped him for dramatics, but his secret ambition was comedy. He quietly admired the comedians at Hanson's and would stand in awe as Milton Berle walked past him en route to his office upstairs. He said Berle represented what I thought comedy was all about. Rickles was shy in the presence of the loud, established drugstore kibitzers. The first time I met Rickles was at the stage door of the Roxy when I was appearing with Tommy Noonan, says Peter Marshall. He was like a little fan. He wasn't going to be a comic. He was going to be an actor. He started hanging around Hanson's, and then he started doing Jackie Leonard's act. Jackie Leonard was the primary insult comedian from the late 1940s to the 1950s. Initially, he did the Chicago presentation house circuit with comic actor Bill House. Jack Waldron, a substitute insult comic from Club 18, took Leonard under his wing and asked Berle to give him gigs in New York. He moved up the ranks quickly and was hosting NBC's Broadway Open House in its final days. Leonard and Rickles had little in common. Their styles were dissimilar, and their careers at different levels. Rickles was in Long Lake, New York, in the summer of 1949, working as a low-level social director at the Skagamore Hotel, while Leonard was a burgeoning star. That autumn, Rickles walked into the office of Phil Webb Attractions across from Rockefeller Plaza. It was known that agent Willie Weber gave inexperienced comedians a chance. Columnist Ralph Pearl wrote, "Weber is a man who spent his life peddling second-rate acts." Weber's portfolio included forgotten comedians Pat Henry, Michael Shaughnessy, and Eddie White. He represented Jackie Gleason when he was a nobody and booked Gleason at Club 18. Weber was small time, but he mentored those rejected by everybody else. His son, Stu, was a Catskill booker, and his grandson, Stephen Weber, became a television star. Comic Don Sherman says, I was raised by Willie Weber. He had all the little clubs owned by the mob guys tied up. Weber sent Rickles on runs through Baltimore, Detroit, Montreal, and Philadelphia. When they weren't interested in a comic, Weber lied and told bookers that Rickles was a harmonica virtuoso. Rickles did hundreds of shows for this guy, Willie Weber, before anybody ever heard of him, says Will Jordan. Hundreds of nightclubs all over the country, hundreds of shows. His act had nothing to do with insults. We're talking 1949, 1950. Rickles would do a bit about a guy in a movie theater sneaking a smoke. Nothing to do with insults, and just as little to do with comedy. Rickles was equipped mostly with the dramatic pieces he'd learned in school. He had very little of an act, this comic, Leo DeLion. He would imitate Peter Lorre, doing an Edgar Allan Poe piece. It was the cornerstone of his early days, the dramatic soliloquy. The Man with the Glass Head was based on an Edgar Allan Poe story, one which Peter Lorre had been doing on the Presentation House circuit. Rickles decided to do it himself. He had glass over his head, says Sammy Shore. I don't know what the hell it was. Dramatic soliloquies did not sit well with drunken nightclub crowds. Heckling was inevitable. When it happened, Rickles responded, and the insult shtick was born. From that, he would go off on a million tangents with the audience, says DeLion. That became his whole persona, insulting and handling them. Rickles crisscrossed the country. He became a regular at Murray Franklin's bar in Miami Beach. Woody Woodbury says, we'd go see him at Murray Franklin's when he was first starting out. He was making anti-Semitic remarks. My friend Al Swartz would say, I don't want to go in there because the Jews hate him. I said, he's Jewish. It was before he was accepted for what he was. These young Jewish kids didn't understand what the hell he was doing. They wanted to come over the goddamn bar and kill him. I met him in Philadelphia, says Jack Carter. He used to work at a place called the Celebrity Room, which was in a back alley. I used to get him dates. We'd go out. He was a nebbish. He was scared to death of women and had no social life at all. We were working bad joints in Washington and Baltimore, and there was this after-hours club called the Alibi Room, this comic Dick Curtis. In those days, you couldn't sell booze after midnight. This was a private after-hours club. Rickles was the MC. He was working so blue, just for strippers and dirty comics. In 1958, a new manager entered his sphere and told him to keep it clean. The guy who took over his career was a mob guy named Joe Scandori, says Curtis. He straightened him out. Scandori was an outfit guy. Scandori and his brother ran a large nightclub in Brooklyn called The Elegant. They opened it with money from their father, the owner of a massive cardboard box factory. Comic Art Mentrano says, I was told right off the bat, don't fuck around with Joe Scardoni. He was pretty well connected. I performed at the Elegant on Ocean Parkway, and he was very kind to me, but people also said, don't do anything wrong. Willie Weber's client, Lou Marsh, says, you don't fool around with Scandori. Scandori, I mean, I'm not saying anything, but Joe had a way of doing things. It was rumored that the Elegant was a front for Johnny Botello, a mobster who worked for the Vito Genovese crime family. I clicked at the Elegant, Rickles wrote in his memoir. That's where my style came together. And Joe was there to witness the whole thing. Joe liked me so much, he bought my contract from Willie Weber and decided to manage me. Leaving Willie wasn't easy, but he understood. No hard feelings. Well, I've been reading from The Comedians by Cliff Nelstroff, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy. It's really a worthwhile read. I wish my voice was in better shape. Oh, man, I'm losing it here. Better get out of here and let Joe Woods come in here. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next month if I make it. Oh, I don't know. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Community Radio, KBOL Portland.
KBOO Portland. As I wake up from my long winter's nap and find my way down the hallway into the studio where I spot that big chair, I take off my sleeping cap and climb up into the big chair so we can be here now. From the corner of Calacala Boulevard and Bourbon Street, from a little Spanish